Welcome to Mastering Agility. If you want to listen to authentic conversations with the most inspiring guests, find like-minded people in the Mastering Agility Discord community or both online and face-to-face events, this is the platform for you. Grab a drink, sit back, and join professional Scrum trainers Sander Doerr, Jim Sammons, and their guests in an all-new episode.
Welcome, everyone, to the next episode of Mastering Agility. This is Jim. I've got my normal co-host, Sander, with me, and we've got an amazing guest today. Goiko, can you please give the audience a quick introduction of yourself?
Hey, everybody. I'm Goiko. It's amazing to be on this show. I'm a developer, kind of used to do lots of consulting, now mostly building my own products, and I like writing books. That's one of the ways I get to kind of empty my short-term cache memory into something longer-term-ish. So I wrote a couple of kind of books that, for whatever reason, became popular. It's amazing. And here we are.
That's right. Well, I've been using your books and the ideas from especially Spec by Example for a number of years now. So that's why I'm really excited to talk to you. But so we're going to dig into that here in just a moment. But Sander, how are you doing?
I'm doing wonderful. Thank you. I'm still riding a good high from teaching a PSPO class yesterday and the day before. It was a really good one. So I'm still riding that high. I'm really enthusiastic, energetic to have Goiko here as well. I mean, in the professional Scrum material, there are references to your book as well. So I'm really hyped to have you here.
Yeah, thank you.
So Goiko, let me just tell you kind of what, or I'll tell you and the audience what I've been the most interested in, which is visualizing specifications. So just to start us off, what I would like to kind of mention is the book Specification by Example. How it helped me and how I use it with teams and clients is moving away from words and adding in pictures, graphs, charts, visuals, examples of what those words mean. So was that where all this started, or what kind of led you to want to write this book in the first place? And, you know, obviously you've written a few, but I'm starting kind of with Specification by Example.
I don't know, kind of, I've always been an edge case. You know, when I moved to the UK from Serbia, I kind of went into the bank to open a bank account. And then after about half an hour of typing all the kind of information people can get from me, the bank clerk said that they can't open my bank account because I've recently been released from prison, which was like, what? And then it turns out that their system kind of, if you're not on the voters registration list, immediately says you've been recently released from prison, because of course that's the only reason why you wouldn't be on the voters registration list when you open a bank account. And so
nice.
And yeah, it's kind of I tried to make good software kind of for as long as I know. You know, when I was a lot younger, I used to be a leader of a team where we would kind of do outsourcing, but we'd kind of charge a fixed price and I'd pay my team members a variable price. So the thing had to go out the first time around and not come back, because if it was coming back, the client wouldn't be paying more and I would be paying people. So kind of, you know, that was opened my eyes to lots of problems with software quality. And then later I started working for some larger organizations where there were lots and lots of people there, and you can see communication problems causing issues. Everybody thought that they knew what they were talking about, but things were just falling through the cracks. So I started looking for ways of solving that. And that's how kind of I picked up on lots of different ideas that were described in the Spec by Example book. So that was actually my third book on that topic. The first book nobody knows about, because I had a contract with the pragmatic programmers that they canceled like when the book was already done and supposed to go to printing, which left it like really in a desperate state. So I self-published that and like nobody knows about that. Then the second one was Bridging the Communication Gap, which was kind of slightly more systematic and had lots of like my experiences. And then I got really angry at a conference in Germany where I was listening to somebody on the stage talking about how in the real world nobody does stuff like that. And how it's purely theoretical. And then I decided, look, I want to do a book that shows how serious organizations are actually using spec, by example, using BDD, using these techniques to solve real problems. So I started kind of getting in touch with everybody I knew that is using this and begging them to do an interview. And then out of that, about 50 different companies accepted, some big, some small. And that's basically what the book, why the book came to exist. I wanted to have something where I could name companies, I could detail their process and extract patterns and show people that, yes, there are people that are doing this in the real world. It's not fairy tale unicorn land and things like that.
Well, that's interesting. Do you have any tips to share or what was the experience like getting that permission from companies to either let you in to see the details of their process or to even be named in a book? And I'll tell you why I'm asking. I'm working with Scrum.org on a case study write-up for two of my clients, and we've been talking, and we all expect one of the biggest hurdles, or the only hurdle maybe, to be getting the getting the approval for a client to be named, because there's a lot of normal reasons that people are hesitant for that. So what was your experience like?
Well, I mean, it took a long time. Let's say that. So, you know, I started the book with that idea. So immediately, kind of when I was interviewing people, I kind of, that was on the table. I wanted to have companies that we could name. And we actually, you know, got a few teams at big banks to sign off on that. We got some larger enterprises to sign off on that. And I think I started the book with that in mind and announced it up front so people would check with their, you know, management or PR departments or whatever if they needed approval for anything. And I gave them plenty of time to review it. So when the interviews were, I first recorded interviews, then turned them into chapters and then kind of sent to people so they could get the internal approval. I think all in all kind of probably took 3 to 6 months to get all the approvals. So plan for plenty of time and, you know, announce that up front, I guess. And then I think, again, the benefit of this was that when I was writing about that topic, it was still like new and fresh and people in these organizations were internal champions who actually wanted to do the same thing as I did. They wanted to show that these things are, you know, these things exist and that their teams are actually that good. And I think for lots of these teams, the book became a really good internal promotion because they could, you know, point to the book in their company and say, look, you know, we've been named as one of the leading teams in this book and we're using something new and cool and important. So I guess it was a win-win for everybody. And it wasn't particularly difficult. It just took a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. I just flipped open the cover of the book and the second printing that I have was from 2012. Ooh. So, I mean, that's 12 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I still am finding people out there that when I mention, you know, specification by example, they're like, you know, they give me that look that tells me they don't know what I'm talking about, which is okay. Right. There's more information out there than we can all consume, but what patterns have you seen over the last 12 years that you're dismayed that they're still persisting? And what benefits or what positive patterns are you seeing in kind of this area of translating what we want to what we actually get?
Look, I mean, in terms of adoption, you know, these ideas have been around for a long time. There's Donald Gauss and Jerry Weinberg wrote a book called Exploring Requirements. It was published in 1989. And you see kind of some common ideas of what they were doing then in spec by example. Ward Cunningham was using this on the Ycash Plus project in probably early 90s. So, you know, even when we were adopting this in 2005, 2006, there was probably somebody who could have said, like, you know, we've done this 30 years ago and the industry is still not adopting it. And I think this is where, you know, we're hitting like Sturgeon's Law, really. Sturgeon's Law says that 90% of anything is going to be crap. So 90% of the teams out there will just not be good at developing software. And they're going to kind of have problems that were self-inflicted and organizationally inflicted that, you know, just they don't want to fix because that's not their bottleneck. And in terms of where these things were going kind of last 10 years or so, I think what's happened since I wrote the book is kind of a consolidation around tooling. When I was writing the book, there were lots of different tools on the market. And I think Cucumber just came out when I was writing the book. I actually wrote the book in 2009. By the time it was all, you know, done and approved and edited, it was already 2010, 2011. So, Cucumber was just emerging back then. And the whole given when then system of describing examples was relatively new because Liz Keogh and Dan North kind of came up with that in 2006, I think. So it took a long time for that thing to, you know, get such a wide adoption. And I think that's the biggest change actually from when the book was published to today. Everybody seems to be doing kind of given when then now as examples. Where it wasn't like that, 15 years ago.
Yeah. So Sundar, you were just teaching a class on product ownership this week. I was catching up with you on WhatsApp and LinkedIn. So did any of these concepts come up in this week for you where it's, you know, maybe requirements, specifications, or just people in the product realm trying to capture what it is that they're trying to build?
Oh yeah, absolutely. The biggest struggle that I see or that I saw in these specific classes were the organizational impediments, where the behavior, especially of middle and higher management, become the bottleneck in the adoption of these kind of things. And by doing so, people tend to be more battling these kind of issues rather than actually doing either discovery work or specification work or figuring out these kind of things. There are so much entailed and struggling with the political games that they don't have any time left anymore to do actual specification work or design or discovery what value actually means. And I'm curious about that in your experience as well, Goiko. What has been the biggest bottleneck in the adoption of the theory that you passionately wrote in your book?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if there's like one single biggest bottleneck, really. And again, I've not really been working as a consultant for quite a long time now, and I don't know what the current situation is. But I imagine, as you said, it's mostly politics and things like that now, because kind of really people that are now starting to adopt Agile are so late to the game. That, you know, the question is why they're now looking at it. And the answer is probably that, you know, they've been stuck in political crap for the last 25 years and now they're looking at it. So, you know, companies like that, nothing's going to help them. And they're going to keep looking at seemingly agile processes that just require them to, you know, rename people and roles like safe and things like that, because they actually, you know, they don't want to build better software. They want to pretend to be better. They want to pretend not to be so late to the game so that they can still hire people. Because you have to have, like, this is now pure marketing. You know, you can't hire people to do waterfall anymore. And but they don't really want to change anything. So I would imagine that, you know, this late in the game, that's actually the key problem. When I was working as a consultant, people were a lot more enthusiastic about actually, you know, doing good work. And I think from that perspective, what I love is the process that Chip and Dan Heath described in Switch. And I've used that with great success lots of times. So Switch is a book about causing organizational change where you don't have really any political or economic influence and how to do that. So it has nothing to do with software, but it's just kind of a book about figuring out how to cause organizational change. And they have lots of really interesting stories, but one kind of thing that stuck with me is they talk about how generally people don't object to change, they object to being changed. And imposing an external thing on them is a problem. And how people often don't like, one of the biggest problems with any process change is that people disagree with the problem, not with the change. So they disagree that they have a specific problem because they might think that something else is a problem or they might not understand the whole picture. They understand only a small part of the whole thing. So kind of what they talk about in the book is like the step number one is to actually visualize the problem, not talk about solutions. And in case of Spec, for example, some problems that Spec, by example, solves is kind of lots of rework caused by misunderstanding, by kind of business bugs, by poorly understood requirements and by assumptions being discovered too late in the game. And the other thing that Spec, by example, tends to solve is a long cycle time from, you know, when we have an idea until it goes out because of kind of fixing and rework and long analysis and things like that. So step number one is kind of visualize the problem. What's the number one thing that's, you know, slowing down the team? What's the number one thing that's causing rework and things like that? And if, you know, these things are actually a big problem for the team, then step number two, according to Chip and Dan Heath, is not to propose BDD spec, by example, automated validation or whatever, but to actually get people involved in designing the solution, to suggest like, okay, what do you think is, you know, how do we improve this process? Let's all kind of put stuff there and vote. And then you can propose your own stuff. And then step number three, they talk about how it's very difficult to get commitment from people for something they don't know. So it's much easier to get a permission for a reversible experiment. And then instead of saying, oh, you know, from Monday, we're going to do spec workshops like this, so we're going to, you know, we're going to try to automate some tests in this way or that way. It's kind of, okay, you know, we read this book by this crazy Serbian guy. Like, let's try it for a couple of weeks. What's the worst that can happen? You know, and so by doing that, you disarm a lot of these things. And there's actually a story in the Spec by Example book about a big data analytics company that my colleague David worked with. And we didn't really, I did not read Chip and Dan Heath's book when I wrote that. So I didn't know about that specific process. But you can see in that kind of story described there pretty much all the aspects of that. David was trying to get them to figure out what's slowing them down at the moment through retrospectives and things like that. They were kind of trying to figure out different solutions that could help with that because he was then proposing his own kind of ideas. Everybody voted on the stuff. And then they selected a few of these kind of ideas to try out as experiments. And when I interviewed them for the book, they were absolutely convinced that they invented the whole process themselves. They were really surprised that anybody else in the world is doing that because it felt like it grew inside this company organically. And they had their own twists on the thing. It wasn't exactly the same as, you know, in everywhere else. But that's so brilliant about this idea. You kind of iterate over it and figure out what's your number one problem, figure out how to solve it. And maybe some of these ideas fit, maybe some of these ideas don't. And I think when you read the original Scrum materials and things like that, pretty much Scrum was supposed to be about something like that. It was supposed to be about pause every couple of weeks, figure out what your number one bottleneck is, and then figure out how to solve it. Everything else that emerged, user stories, planning poker, retrospectives, spec by example, BDD, all of these other things, they're all solutions for specific problems that people are finding along the way. And in some cases, these solutions can be translated, you know, from one team to another. In some cases, they can't. And the original Scrum material was like this thin, and now these books called Essential Scrum that are kind of hundreds of pages, which is ridiculous because we're just kind of copying solutions from other places where it's not necessarily that they fit in a specific environment.
Now, from your experience, because figuring out what the problem actually is a very daunting thing. I mean, if everyone has their opinion, and especially in the modern day and age, everyone has a very strong opinion about any single detail, then how do you make sure that you objectively define what the problem actually is?
Well, I mean, you can track, where people are wasting time. You can figure out what causes delays in what aspect. But if you want to go like full McKinsey, then there's, time in motion studies and things like that. But generally, my experience, people in a team kind of have a pretty good idea what their number one problem is. And if you let them expose these things and vote for them, you'll figure out for a specific team what's kind of causing the biggest issue at that very moment without a lot of bureaucracy. But yeah, you could do value stream mapping, you could do kind of figuring out where things are in the queue and tracking how long a specific Jira ticket spends in what state and figuring out what people are spending time on or wasting time on during the day. I remember one case, I used to work as a consultant for a big hedge fund. And when we started looking at where developers are wasting the most amount of time, it was waiting for virtual machines to start up in the morning. There's nothing to do with anything else because, the company kind of implemented this whole disaster recovery policy where everybody had to use virtual machines so that if a computer dies, their work is not interrupted. And everybody comes in at the same time in the morning. They all turn on the computers, they try to log in, and the virtual machine system just takes like 40 minutes to allocate the virtual machine, which is ridiculous. If you multiply that with, the number of programmers and the salaries that they were getting, like the economics of that, you can buy a whole data center for that money per year. Adopting TDD at that point or adopting Kanban or adopting Spec by example or user stories, I would not solve the number one bottleneck. What solved the number one bottleneck is taking that data to kind of the business stakeholders and saying, this is insane. Look how much money you're paying just for people to wait for virtual machines to start up. And then we got a permission for programmers to use physical machines, not virtual machines, because all the work is anyway in version control systems. So if a programmer machine dies, it's not that big of a deal. But it's just figuring out what people feel that they're wasting time on usually produces good results.
I was trying to help a client with a problem recently, and I was making it visual. I was using facts and screenshots and pulling up screens and saying, this is what I'm seeing. Do we agree that there's a problem here? And the answer I got mostly was, yeah, of course. Now, what do you recommend? I'm like, okay, so it's great that one person agreed that they see the problem, but the solution or suggestions would have impacted hundreds and hundreds of people and cost, six to maybe even seven figures in the long run. And I said, I don't feel comfortable making a suggestion yet until more people agree that there's a problem. Because to your earlier point, people don't resist change. They resist being changed. So I think that the way this technique helps is I see myself and you two may agree as we're catalysts for change. We're not the change. We're creating the change, or maybe facilitating is even a better word, a desire to change. How would you, or what's been your experience when people don't intrinsically or internally step towards change? So like to Chip and Dan He's point, don't try and change them, because as a consultant, I try and not mandate changes or even really suggest specific changes. But if you're hired to be a consultant to come in and help the group or team or whatever the organism is do something different. And how do you create that internal drive to want to step towards change?
No, no, that's not really a question for me. As I said, I've not been working as a consultant in this space for a long time now. I started building my own products. So when I used to work as a consultant, this was still new and fresh, and people were enthusiastic about that. So I would have been hired by people who already kind of feel that they want to kind of change. And a lot of my work wasn't done on generic kind of agile transformations and things like that, because there were lots of people doing that already. My work was around much more kind of specific techniques that people have kind of already identified that they want to use, or at least they want to try. So yeah,
that sounds
that's
awesome.
That's not really unfortunately
I want that.
Unfortunately, yeah, I think the situation with people adopting these things 15 years ago or 20 years ago was completely different from people adopting it now.
Yeah. So that's a good segue. Tell us what you've been up to, because I'm intrigued by the fact that I see you as a great author and practitioner. And for the audience, the Goyko's books are extremely dense and with what I call pragmatic ideas. Like one chapter in the right hands or in the right, when there is a need, there is packed full of actionable, simple things that you can begin using tomorrow. So what have you been doing over the last 5 years? I'd love to just kind of understand what you're building and how COVID affected
you. My colleague Dave DeFlorini and I built a mind mapping tool a while ago, and that really took off. And it's reasonably popular now, and we're working on maintaining that. And I wrote a tool to help people create narrated videos easily from PowerPoints and from Markdown and kind of documentation videos, promo videos and things like that. And that's actually kind of taken off like mad the last couple of years. Last year I had something like 8.5 million active users, and I'm the only person working on it. I'm the only sales, pre-sales, developer, tester, product owner, ops and everything.
Wow.
That's kind of been an interesting thing. I still occasionally kind of do some workshops with people, mostly around impact mapping and things like that. And I'm writing a new book now called Lizard Optimization that's going to come out in a few months' time. It's based on the experiences with growing NeuroKit and MindMap, where a lot of the work that really kind of unlocked growth came out of identifying edge cases and outliers in user behavior and kind of figuring out how to transform these things into ideas to make better products.
Mastering agility only works with organizations aligned with our values, and that's exactly why we are excited to work with our sponsor. Scrum Match is the free platform for professionals run by professionals. On Scrum Match, true Scrum Masters get hired by companies serious about their popular framework. The awesome people behind this platform have decades of experience, among them a professional Scrum trainer for Scrum.org. They have interviewed, trained, and coached hundreds of like-minded people, and they use this exact experience to make you stand out from the crowd and help you get in touch with companies looking for true Scrum Masters. So go to scrummatch.com and sprint to your dream job. Both Jim and I are experienced consultants and trainers. Therefore, we know how important it is for organizations to have the fundamentals in place before delivering high-value products. And this starts with understanding the theory behind whatever framework, method, or process organizations apply. And this is where Zebia comes in. Zebia is a pioneering software engineering and IT consultancy company, transforming and executing at the intersection of domain and technology to create digital leaders for our people, clients, partners, and communities. As a gift for our Mastering Agility audience, they provided us with a discount code MA10 when signing up for their open enrollment classes to get 10% off. Go to zebia.com/academy to find the entire curriculum of courses. That is zebia.com/academy to find all their courses. There is this statement in the professional Scrum material, or a true or false statement that students need to figure out whether you can be a Scrum team with two people. And I think I need to revise my answer, because you just demonstrated you can be a single man army just by yourself and do an entire product.
I think, you know, the what's happened over the last 10, 15 years is the bar to create new products has kind of lowered significantly. I had a company in 2008, 2009 where we were making a product and there were, you know, five or six developers. We had a tester, we had a product owner, we had an infrastructure person, and then all the other kind of supporting stuff around that. And there's so many kind of better tools now for operations, for kind of doing the heavy lifting around things that are not really core to the business, that you can have, you know, a relatively successful product done by two people or one person. And then, you know, there's interesting dynamics that happen there. And I think especially now with all this kind of generative AI and co-pilots and things like that, the bar is going to be kind of even lower. And a single person will be able to do a lot more. But then, you know, this does require quite a lot of cross-role knowledge and cross-role work. I think I've been blessed by touching lots of different parts of the software process, so I know how to do development and testing, and I'm, you know how to do product management. I'm still struggling with enterprise sales and things like that. That's not really my key skill, but it's an ongoing learning process, and I think we will. It's going to be really interesting what's going to happen over the next 10 years or so once all these code generation tools mature a bit more.
Yeah. I saw a headline the other day that said, and I'm paraphrasing, but it basically said all of the no-code tools are going to be in products are going to be built, are going to be moving towards low-code. So what I inferred from that is, no code is a starting point for, you know, non-coders like me, maybe to get a proof of concept going. But then as soon as you want to customize it or add significant complexity, you probably need someone like you. Do you see that as being the case, or do you see those tools just getting smarter and remaining kind of what is called no code today?
I don't know, like this whole no code promise again is something that I remember when I started working, people were doing case tools and 4GL languages, and everybody was talking about how case tools will replace developers because you can get a business person to just describe what they want in a case tool and it's magically going to happen. And that didn't materialize. And then there were all these kind of business process management tools and things like that later and app generators. And that never really took off again, because as you said, it's you get the prototype working, and then after that, you know, there's a problem there. But the way I look at these things is, you know, there's been a huge progression from people doing physical wires to doing bits and bytes, and then doing assembly, and then doing compiled languages and things like that. And I actually used to be a decent assembly developer. I was able to kind of optimize code better than the C++ compiler before WOTCOM 8.5 came out. And then that defeated me the first time around. And I think, you know, I remember doing my own memory allocation libraries and things like that. But then I started using Java and I kind of forgot how to manage memory. And I think there's a progression of these things where we're getting better tools to be more effective. And on the other hand, I think what's been happening, especially with Jupyter and things like that in the industries, that we're democratizing what it means to be a developer. We have people who are not necessarily, who wouldn't be called software developers 20 years ago, who are now able to develop software because of these tools, whether they're low code or no code or something like that. And you have these data scientists, you have business users that are able to apply their knowledge to create automation. And I think that's where, you know, a parallel I like to use for that is spreadsheets or you know, Excel or VisiCalc and things like that. VisiCalc came out in 1979 and created a complete revolution because it put kind of all these calculation tools and statistical tools in the hands of regular people. And now we have Excel and Google Sheets and things like that as kind of the most popular iteration of that, but it democratized all this kind of work and it gave people powerful tools to do things. And of course, then you have people abusing it and misusing it and getting overconfident. Like there was a case during the COVID pandemic where the British government actually managed the list of COVID cases in Excel, and then they lost 20,000 people because, you know, somebody who should have really built a database wanted to use Excel. They were comfortable with that. And I think, you know, what I'm trying to say is all these tools that are emerging, whether you call them no code, low code, whatever, they're going to help people create automation. You know, now you can, Greg Brockman from OpenAI demonstrated this thing where you can use a wireframe, hand-drawn wireframe, and create a web app. I read yesterday that Google has this prototype where it can generate a platform video game from a description and things like that. So these things are going to be really great for prototyping, for first cut attempts, and maybe even for, you know, getting some simple automation in place. And then you can figure out where you want to optimize it and where you want to do different things and maybe kind of get people to tighten it up or create something stronger. So I think, you know, what, going back to spec by example and things like that, I think what, you know, the power that we're kind of hopefully going towards is people being able to take their human knowledge and express it in some way and then get that translated into software without so many layers of interpretation.
And that is what I have picked up on in the last number of years, like tools like FigJam and Zeppelin and some of these other like visualization tools have made it easier than ever for and Mural and Miro and other such tools, but they've made it easier for business people or leaders to take an idea that's in their brain about what they want and sit down with someone like you and say, okay, now I see we're talking about the same things. Have we considered this? And they've really not replaced the doing of the work, but they've created an on-ramp or increased the shared understanding of what it is maybe somebody is after. And you know, one of the other things you mentioned that I was working with a group this week, and this idea of two primary types of developers being out there, and I know that there is far more than two, but there's a lot of people I run into that want to do one thing. They want to be a specialist and they want to kind of treat their proverbial desk as like an inbox outbox. Like, give me what you want me to do, let me do it, and it's going to go to the outbox. And then there's other people who sounds like yourself, you know, you're doing pre-sales, you're doing operations, you're doing this, that probably you enjoy doing that. And I don't think you would do it if you didn't enjoy it in some way, but you probably likely had to decide what you don't do, what you outsource and all that. So do you see a shift or is the industry not changed much in the last 20 years from, you know, maybe the subject matter experts versus that more entrepreneurial Jack and Jill of all trades type mentality?
Yeah, that's I don't know. I don't have a good overview of the industry, but I think, you know, generally what I would expect to happen and to be happening slowly is that as we're getting better tools, you can do a lot more with a smaller group of people. And that means that you no longer need, you know, 1,000 people to do something. Of course, there's a big question whether you needed 1,000 people in the first place to do that. But right. It's going to be less, you know, more and more difficult to justify having so many people sitting and doing kind of simplistic stuff. I mean, the same way how when we got better tool around automated testing, it all of a sudden became really difficult to justify having people there sitting and manually clicking and going through scripts. And then some portion of that, those people, they started focusing more on things where you really need a human brain, and they started doing more exploratory testing. They started becoming experts in that kind of stuff, and the automation, you know, went the other way. But you know, some portion of those people just, you know, wasn't needed anymore. And I think the way these things kind of seem to work is once you have organizations no longer needing that many people, they kind of tend to go and work for smaller organizations that tend to start their own work. I think, you know, like if you look at what's been happening in Sweden, everybody used to work for Ericsson, and then Ericsson wasn't doing that well. And then people left and started Klarna, started Spotify, started King, started, you know, all these things. And then out of these people, you know, you have people starting iZettle or starting Mojang and doing all these other things. And then kind of there's lots and lots of kind of new products there. And Stockholm is now a massive IT hub where kind of people have, I think, been able to create products with smaller and smaller groups of people. And I think that's probably what's going to be happening in the future, or at least that's what I would like to see. In terms of, you know, whether you have specialists that just like doing one thing or generalists, I think that's more a kind of personality thing. And I think in the future, we're probably going to be seeing both groups still. You will still have kind of highly effective specialists doing a specialist task, but there will be a lot more kind of general purpose work as well. You know, for me personally, I was like fascinated with software as a kid because to me that was the closest thing to magic. You can kind of say some magic words or type some magic words somewhere and, you know, poof, something appears. And it's amazing. And I've always enjoyed building products. I've not just enjoyed programming. And that's why I probably gravitated towards kind of this side of the work. And I've tried to learn how to do product management, how to do testing, how to do all sorts of other things. There's nothing wrong in being extremely good at one specific type of work and then working on that. It's just, I think the marketplace for those kind of things is going to be shrinking and shrinking and shrinking.
What I'm curious about in that sense, because you're talking about AI, etc., that made me think about your closing keynote for the Agile Tour of Vienna in Austria September. We were both speaking there, and I was there. Which, by the way, even the start before your talk actually started was hilarious, just for the audience. You used ChatGPT, I think it was the Irish co-host, used ChatGPT.
Robert,
to generate your own introduction, like give me an introduction on who Gojko Adjic is, just in the version of an Irish leprechaun, and then he would read it out loud in his full Irish accent. It was genius. But your talk was about whether, because of ChatGPT, whether developers, analysts, etc., are still necessary, and we were talking about the political games within the organization. Do you think /hope that ChatGPT or any other generative AI tool is going to help eradicate or at least minimize the amount of political games that are needed in an organization?
I don't think so. I think political games exist because people like playing political games. I think People like behaving like feudal lords and having their kind of budgets and things like that. And there's a technology is not going to solve that. That's like a cultural dimension. And I don't think technology solves culture. I think other things are necessary. But what I think is going to happen, and where, you know, you can see the patterns of technology, what technology is doing, is technology is eliminating middlemen. Technology is eliminating middlemen in hotel bookings. You know, this 30 years ago, people used to go to an agency and then book a hotel or book a flight. Technology eliminated that. You have like technology eliminating middlemen in all sorts of areas. And I think one aspect of that might be that technology is going to start eliminating middlemen in organizations, which is kind of middle management. Because in lots of organizations, middle management is kind of, I don't know, a glorified email exchange. They kind of, you know, it's kind of, you know, if you can replace somebody with Excel and a few email rules, it's difficult to justify their job there. But a lot of the times, the middle management is also where the organizational change happens. They're the ones that are pushing through organizational change, which is now, you know, there's an interesting dynamic there. What happens when you eliminate the middle management? Is anybody kind of able then to push through an organizational change anymore or not? So that's kind of the interesting dimension of that. And maybe, as I said, I think technology kind of, and automation in general, doesn't make things better or worse. It makes them faster. So we can speed up the information exchange at the company. We can speed up the distribution of ideas from top to bottom and from bottom to top and sideways and matrix ways, whatever. But if these ideas are not good, then it doesn't really matter if they're slow or fast. Even worse, you know, if you have a horrible idea and you speed up the kind of transition of that, then you just make mess faster. So lots of these kind of political things are, I think, cultural responses, and technology is not going to solve that, but maybe it will lead to smaller organizations and then by implication kind of smaller politics.
Interesting. Well, thank you for that perspective. Gives me something to think about. And I was almost hoping that you would say, yeah, that's going to happen, or that, you know, because of the digging into the problems and where to find the problems. And in many organizations, the middle management, not necessarily the people, but the behavior can tend to be a big problem, either because of a hidden agenda or, you know, reluctance to change or whatever reason there is. And if we're going to be using AI tools or whatever to speed up this process, then I would imagine these problems would become even more transparent, even faster. So we have to deal with it a lot faster as well.
Yeah, possibly. But I said, you know, if you look at, like, I said, you know, this is an agile podcast. If you look at kind of adopting agility and things like that, usually it's kind of the middle management that's pushing these things through. It's not the kind of the, you know, it's very rare that a CEO of a bank really kind of wants to be in control of a process or how the process changes. These people kind of, have different level of needs and engagements and things like that. Whether we end up with fully autonomous teams and things like that, that's an interesting thing, because then you still need coordination between these things. And somebody will need to do orchestration, coordination, and a bunch of other things. With better technology, maybe fewer middle managers will be able to organize this whole thing. But then again, you know, Cyril Parkinson in 1950s did this analysis of bureaucratic organizations, and he concluded that regardless of what you do, bureaucracy grows about 5% a year. And, you know, he talked about how when you have administrators, kind of administrators tend to find more work for administrators, and that grows and grows and grows. And, you know, you can see that in lots of these kind of enterprise Scrum teams, where Scrum Masters tend to hire more Scrum Masters. And we create, kind of additional levels of bureaucracy, and they tend to be obsessed with the process itself rather than the purpose of the organization, which is really ironic considering, you know, the original ideas of Agile, where you're not supposed to kind of be fixated on the process. So I think it's just a natural thing with, you know, larger organizations. They get slow and bureaucratic and bloated, and then they die off. Smaller organizations take over, and that's just a natural cycle of these things happening.
What was the book or the author?
Cyril Parkinson. He's famous for like Parkinson's Law. He looked at kind of bureaucracy and things like that. I think there's a good article on the Economist website describing kind of his conclusions. I don't think he actually published a book. I think he published on the Economist magazine.
Yeah, that's what I thought you had referenced. I just wanted to clarify, because when I read that book again earlier this year, and I think one of the original published dates on it was like 1962 or something. And a lot of the stories came from like British Navy in the 30s and 40s. So it kind of shows you none of these problems are new. And one of the things I took away from that was there's only a few solutions to this, which is the organization either continues this cycle of bureaucratic growth, or it almost has a phoenix type thing where it crashes, burns, and then reemerges as something new. And I think that's what we see in the workplace, in these big companies, spin off small companies, small startups, little dojos, you know, whatever words you want to use. And then those get bigger and they IPO and they're $1 billion valuation. And then they have all the same problems that they were created to avoid in the first place. And it's this very predictable cycle. It's still very profitable, but it's also kind of predictable that with size comes complexity and complexity comes problems. And yeah, it's I highly encourage anybody that's interested in like organizational dynamics to, it's great if they know what Parkinson's Law is, but it's a very quick read, the work behind it. And there's a lot of nuggets in that. I want to come back because I see the time. We're getting right up to the time. I want to ask just maybe a quick question. You can give me a black and white answer, or you can expand on it a little. Is, do you think people and teams spend too much time, not enough time, or just the right amount of time on edge cases, negative use cases, et cetera? Because you referenced that a few times. And
I mean, if you look at how much shit software is out there, then it's obvious that people are not spending enough time. You know, like yesterday, I was traveling on kind of by British Rail here, and all the trains were delayed because they had some kind of signaling problems at a big junction. And you know, they can put any excuses they want, but you and I know it's because it was the 29th of February, and all the software that they developed last 4 years that wasn't testing for that kind of exploded yesterday. And, right. You know, things like this happen, and at the same time, as you mentioned, you know, software is extremely profitable at the moment, and then the question is, if we can get away with, if companies can get away with such rubbish software, should they actually create better software or not? I mean, is the software good enough? But there's an economic component to that, of course. There's like a political component to that. You know, there's in England at the moment, there's a contentious issue. There was some software developed by Fujitsu Siemens a while ago that was doing accounting for post offices. And they had some bugs, you know, in the accounting software that was reporting that the post office operators are basically stealing money from the post office. Lots of people went to prison. Some people even committed suicide. They were ruined. And then it turns out, you know, these were software bugs. And now there's a big political issue with kind of the government trying to figure out what to do and how to restore these people, you know, who went to prison and who lost their livelihoods and jobs and things like that. So, you know, bad software tends to have more and more systemic implications on because it's everywhere now. And I think software is going to be more controlling of our societies and communities and governments. And there is a responsibility professionally for us to create good software and deal with all these edge cases. But as I said, I think while nobody's going to prison and everybody's still very profitable churning out bad software, it's very unlikely that the tide will turn.
Does that have right. to do with educating the user as well? Because apparently we're just en masse accepting it.
Well, I think it has to do with educating the user, but I think it has to do with also, you know, like not really... it has to do with risk transfer. I think, you know, it's one of the kind of... There's a popular comedy duo in England called Mitchell and Webb, and they have this phenomenal sketch where... the bank calls somebody to tell them that all the money is gone because of identity theft. And they're trying to argue whether identity theft is kind of the right way to call it, because that person still has the same identity. It's kind of the bank that's given away the money, and somebody, you know, defrauded the bank because of a problem, and the bank is not accepting it. No, it's not kind of, you know, it's not the bank's problem, it's your problem. You have, you know, identity theft. And that's ridiculous. I mean, what does identity theft even mean? So I think we as a society have been kind of transferring the negative consequences of bad software to users. And that's a political problem. I think only relatively recently have people started going to prison for actually programming stuff that was illegal. There was, I think, that the people that did the Volkswagen cheating in the US, one developer went to prison, and I think the two developers that did Bernie Madoff's kind of software went to prison. But those are all kind of relatively recent developments. Yeah. I don't think that, you know, there were any consequences for anybody doing horrible software, even illegal software, you know, before. And usually people will just get away with that. And I think for something like that to change in a society, the governments would have to step in and start imposing, start shifting where the downsides of these things are. If you look at, like, you know, Experian and all these kind of people losing people's private data in the US, all of a sudden, you know, everybody's private data is available on the internet, and people can go and get a mortgage in your name, but it's your fault. It's not the Experian fault that they kind of leak the data or allow the data to be stolen, which is insane, totally insane. So I think this is a political problem. It's not a technological problem.
Yeah. Well, this is an amazing take on it. Like, I mean, I kind of realized some of these bigger societal things, but I'm just so happy to hear you verbalize it. And this week I saw a headline about one of the big security companies was fined, lost a court case for basically their security product was actually selling customer data. So the very people you're paying a service and for software to protect you is selling your data to the very people who perpetuate identity theft and all that. But you're bringing up, it's a business problem. Like that, if that fine is not significant enough to change the industry, they could chalk it up as a business expense and say, well, yeah, I mean, we're still
absolutely
making
that's
a
why
ton of
you
money.
Know all the EU fines to Facebook are pointless, I think, you know. But that's a societal problem. I think as an industry, you know, we are still relatively young. I mean, if you look at architecture or something like that, where doing such shoddy work would probably land you in prison and you would lose a license and things like that. That's how society solves these problems. But kind of with software, I think there's still too much demand and too little supply. So we're not able to, the societies are not able to create controls like that. And I think, you know, who knows, 50 years from now, maybe the situation is going to be different, but I'm not particularly hopeful that something is going to change big in the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, that's kind of what makes me think what Dave Snowden said on this podcast as well, where he's envisioning that IT should become a profession, and then you would get the same bar like you would get in advocacy or with the medical doctors and surgeons. And you have to keep yourself accountable for the quality that you deliver, basically. And if you deliberately endanger other people, for instance, with the Dieselgate from Volkswagen or what Bernie Madoff and his stupid pyramid scheme were doing, yeah, then you're 100% criminally liable.
Yeah, and I think, you know, those are changes that have started happening last couple of years. And I think that's going to keep happening. But, you know, on one hand, you have these kind of clear-cut criminal cases, and that's easy to pursue. But on the other hand, you have these kind of, oh, it's a stupid bug things, you know, like somebody hacked us and we've leaked all the customer data or something like that. Or, you know, the software is doing accounting badly and kind of people are going to prison for that I don't think, you know, these cases are kind of, there's a line between all these things. And I think what I would love to see is this profession thing. I would love to see, you know, the equivalent of chartered accountants and things like that. But I don't think that can happen when things are shifting so quickly and stuff, you know, there's still so much need for development. I think maybe, you know, we were talking about tools bringing productivity and things that maybe if these tools really bring so much productivity in the next 20 years, there's not going to be a need for so many developers and so much kind of work developing software, then you can actually create something like a chartered profession.
Yeah. I mean, Zuckerberg said, I think last week or the week before, that they're seeing the benefits of being a leaner organization. So I think two things are going to probably affect this. One is, I think a lot of large companies are realizing that they don't have to be doing as much. Like, there's value in being leaner and getting out the red pen and the scissors to our roadmaps and plans and saying, trying to find that 20% of the things that we should be doing and somehow letting go of the 80%. But when it affects real humans, because those companies are terrible at doing that and then start to do it, it's a problem. And that's why you see mass layoffs and all these things in the headlines. But I was in IT during Y2K, and you referencing February 29th is interesting, because what I realized years after Y2K is there's always these periods of extreme innovation, and then that leads to new problems. So like Y2K led to a bunch of problems, and it led to a bunch of new solutions and consulting and all this other stuff. And then the dot-com era led to a massive influx in growth, but then it also led to a massive influx in identity theft and commerce issues and money moving around and all these different things. And then there's a shift, right? So it'll be interesting to see what the post-COVID world and the AI, the new generative AI LLM world will indicate. And like, if we're in the middle of the bubble, like, you normally don't know if you're in the bubble until after it bursts. So I have no idea, and I'm not some expert, if we're in it, if we're looking at it, if it's behind us or what, but it will be interesting to see what the next 3 to 5 years brings.
Yeah, and you know, I think you've mentioned, you know, you create something and then, you know, it creates completely new things. And, you know, we who would have imagined, like, you know, such a proliferation of mobile apps and everything going digital and things like that in, you know, 1995 or 6 or 7, you know, when the dot-com bubble was starting. And there's all these things that are now are changing the context. There's these two UX laws, like joke laws, I really like. Larry Tesler had this law of the conservation of complexity. And his law was that you can't really reduce complexity, you can only shift it around. So, you know, you can make the front end more complicated and the back end simpler, or you can make the product more complicated and simplify the user workflow, or you can create a simpler product and keep the user workflow more complicated. But kind of, you're saying that product development and UX people talking about reducing complexity is a lie. Complexity just kind of shifts around. And then Bruce Tonazzini, who worked for Microsoft, created like a paradox to that. He said, you don't, like, yes, you don't reduce complexity, but what's actually happening is you give people a tool and they become more ambitious because they now have more power. They can complete more work in 1 hour, so they start doing more complicated things. So complexity actually increases. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one of the reasons why, you know, this perennial thing where software developers complain that users don't know what they want. Of course, there's, you know, part of it is lack of understanding and analysis communication, but there's also a big part where when you give business users a tool, all of a sudden they have more time, but they still have 8 hours a day to fill in with work. So they start doing more complicated work. And then they have new requirements that need to be put into the tool that you've built because they want to, or, you know, they can do more complex workflows now, and they have more power. And then when you automate those workflows, the cycle continues. They can do more complex stuff, and you know, they have more power. So I think what you've described is kind of that happening, but on a societal scale, where, you know, we didn't have internet before, but now we have internet. We can do more powerful things, you know. And then we didn't have internet on mobile phones everywhere, but then once we had that, we can do more powerful things. And all these things are kind of changing all the time with the cloud, with, you know, AI. And I think it's going to be interesting to see what are the new use cases, what are kind of the new things we do, and where complexity grows from there.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Like, we could talk for hours. I just want to thank you again for your time. And Sundar, you want to wrap us up?
I've got one last question that has been stuck in my head since the beginning of this conversation. When your bank in the UK said, you cannot open a bank account because you've been to prison, what went through your head?
No, I knew it was some kind of shit software. So, you know, I started arguing with them. I had a flight ticket that showed that I came in 2 days ago, and I said, you know, I wasn't in this country, you know, more than 2 days ago. You know, how would you even know if I was recently released from prison somewhere else? And then, you know, the lady was, these people know that their software is shit. So, you know, she called somebody who came 10 minutes later, pressed some kind of weird key combination to proceed to the next screen. And that worked out. But it's you know, really, and then, you know, that person explained why the software was saying that. But I think.
Sounds like Sandra Bullock in The Net trying to like hold down the mouse button and click on the weird symbol.
You know, horrible software affects people's lives. And you know, as a software professional, somehow I feel that, you know, we should be taking more accountability and responsibility for that as an industry. But as you mentioned, it is a commercial thing. So if you can get away with a small fine when something like that happens, or even, you know, completely shift it to the user, there's no incentive for people to build better software. Right.
Exactly. As long as the benefits still outweigh the consequences, then this is going to be perpetuated forever. Goiko, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. And again, I second what Jim said. I think we can go on for hours talking like this, but we also realize it's Friday afternoon. So we're going to let you go. Thank you so much for being here. Likewise.
Bye-bye. Thank you very much.
That is all for today. Thank you for listening. If you liked this episode, let us know by hitting that like button, share it with friends and colleagues, sharing a message on LinkedIn, joining our warm and welcoming Discord community, or attend recordings as a virtual audience. You can find all the relevant links in the show notes. We hope you'll tune back in for the next episode of the Mastering Agility Podcast.